Hello, strangers. We're back. It's been a little while, but welcome along to the Before and Podcast. This Monday, the 11th of September. Like I say, because of bank holidays and everything else, we've kind of been away for a month. So, thank you very much for joining us. If you are joining us on YouTube right now, we are live. Good evening to you. The chat window is open. If, like the majority of you, you're catching up later in the week, good afternoon, good evening, good morning to you, whatever time of the day it is. Thank you very much for downloading and listening to the Avery Vaughan's podcast. It is appreciated. And of course, you can reach out to us either through the podcast forum on AV Forums, find this podcast, leave your question in there, or send us an email, podcast@avforums.com, and we'll read it out a little bit later. And that's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to go through some of the feedback. But before that, I have to introduce everybody that's on the podcast tonight. So we've got regulars, Ed Selly, Martin Dew, Julian Scott, and of course, Ian Collin reading the news. Good evening, guys.
Good evening, Phil.
Good evening, Phil.
Right. So what are we doing tonight? We've had a month to organize this podcast, and as always, 4 minutes too, we're busy scrambling for things to do. That's no fair. Andy's actually been working hard on the running order, and tonight we're going to be talking about Panasonic's flagship OLED TV. I reviewed it a couple of weeks ago, the MZ2000 OLED. It has MLA, micro lens array technology built in, plus Panasonic's proprietary heatsink technology. But does that make a difference? It is the brightest TV that I have measured so far this year, but does that mean it's the best? We'll answer that question if you haven't already read the review and watched the video on YouTube. Martin's going to be looking at the Yamaha RX-A4A AV receiver, and if we've got time, we'll also cover a subwoofer that he's also been looking at. It's created quite a bit of discussion on the forums. Ed has been looking at some name kits, so we're going to talk a little bit about that. And of course, we've got our usual roundup of TV, home cinema, and hi-fi news from Ian. So that's everything that's lined up. You also notice that Jules is here. Jules is going to ask some questions about displays, and we're going to go through a few bits and pieces because there has been some news that's come out of Cydia, which is obviously Jules' area of the market, custom install, that kind of thing, and professional display. So we'll cover a little bit of that a little bit later on. And right. So chat window, like I say, is open. We're going to look at some of the feedback we've had from previous podcasts. And the first one is from the podcast on the 14th of August, which I believe was the last one that we did, where I spoke about the Panasonic MZ980. And there's a couple of questions came in from Toon Army. Good evening, Toon Army, if you're listening tonight or a little bit later in the week. He says, I do feel that Sony and Panasonic lose business with the later releases of their ranges every year. It allows LG to gain a foothold in the market, with reviews, marketing, and so on, ahead of the price reduction cycle. Why do they have later releases? You've just answered your own question, because LG make the panels. Well, LG Display make the panels, and they sell them to LG Electronics, who get them before everybody else. Also, LG do their own silicon. So silicon on chip is all done by LG, whereas other manufacturers have to use other chips and their own processing and so on. So by the time that they get the panels in the production process, it's a little bit later than LG Electronics. And that means that if there's any issues like Sony's delay this year, which we believe, although, don't quote me on this, but we believe that that's been caused by them wanting to put the new Pentonic chipset into their flagship TVs this year. That's caused a little bit of delay with the QLED. Their WRGB OLED, though, has been out for a little while, but it's more or less the same as last year's TV. They didn't add anything new. So there you go. That's kind of why that happens. LG have a foothold. LG make the panels. The same as Samsung with QD OLED. They get their sets out before Sony. So that's how that works. I mentioned in that podcast that the MZ1500, which is the middle of the range, so you got the 2000, the 1500, the 980. We reviewed the 980 and the 2000. The 1500, it used to have the same panel as the 2000, so the same flagship panel, but it dropped the Atmos speakers. So you were more or less buying a monitor. It did have a sound system, but you're more or less buying a monitor with the best panel. They're not doing that this year. The 1500 is a completely different panel to the flagship. So there's only the 2000 that gets the MLA panel, the micro lens array panel. The 1500 gets the heatsink, but it doesn't get micro lens array. So it sits in the middle, and Panasonic have done that for a reason, and that's to make sure that there is different upsell for their products in the shops. So if you want just a basic WRGB OLED TV from Panasonic, then the 980 is a cracking set. The 1500 sits in the middle. The 2000 has the MLE and the Dolby Atmos. And then it says, this is an interesting one because me and Jules are going to give you our thoughts on this one. Again, it's from Toon Army. He said, with regards to TV settings, why don't manufacturers provide the ability to save them to a USB stick for later use?
Why don't they, Phil?
Well,
we've been saying this for years.
Yeah, we have. And to be fair, some manufacturers do put ISF modes in there. So if a professional calibrator comes along, there are codes that can be punched in. I mean, up, down, left, right is one of them on the remote. You've got to be on a certain page to do that. There's other things like Info 085 for a well-known brand of TV will get you into the ISF menus where you can calibrate the TV and then lock that down. So the end user gets the ISF day or ISF night settings. But, Jules, there's never been something for enthusiasts, has there, where they can put their settings in once they're happy with it, then download those settings, other than sitting and downloading it to a piece of paper with a pen?
Well, no, there hasn't. But even the ISF settings, which allow you to lock them if you ever have to reset your TV for whatever reason, unless you've got them written down, you're going to lose those. And that's,
can we drag ourselves kicking and screaming into the 21st century here, gentlemen? I believe that we're all in possession of something called a mobile telephone. It's extremely exciting technology. Now, the last time I checked, they've got cameras on them. And, you can take a photo of that. You can even save them in a file marked My TV Settings. You can then, if you've got Android or Apple, have them so they appear on all of your devices. And I'd argue that that's possibly more versatile than being able to save them to a stick that you will lose or will corrupt itself.
Probably. I do that with all the review sets. Every time I take a photo of the menus as soon as I put the settings in, so I can, because I'm then changing the settings and, uh-huh. and trying to benchmark the sets and see if I can push them too far. But yeah, that's Ed's hit the nail on the head, really.
That's been spending literally weeks every year calculate the time it takes me to record somebody's settings from their TV for up to seven picture modes, and it's literally weeks of my life just sitting there copying calibration settings into a Word file, and I've handed those for years to clients. But it's the faff. If it ever goes wrong, you've got to put them in manually again to be able to just back it up onto a USB stick. If you ever had the need, put it back in again. Zap your TV with those settings again, and they're there, which saved my time. And for enthusiasts, it's great. And I don't know why people haven't done this, manufacturers haven't done this earlier.
Yeah, but the manufacturer has done this now.
One of them, yes.
Certainly one of them is going to do it. So tell us about that, Jules, because it kind of leaked out of Cedia this year.
Yeah, it's leaked out, and I'm quite excited by this, as you can tell. JVC. The first one to do this with their projectors. So the NZ series of projectors are going to get the ability to back up the settings onto a USB stick, which is awesome. So whether that backs up the internal gamma tables, which you have to fix with the additional software, I don't know. Is it just the user side of the settings? I don't know. But it's a good move, and I'm glad that JVC are doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. And it'll be interesting to see how that works. So just sticking with JVC while we're here, because I don't think it's actually down the page either. They have also, again, this is a manufacturer. I know Ed's going to agree with me on this one as well, because we've been banging on about it for ages in terms of product cycles and, do you have to replace kit every year and so on. JVC, once again, are offering a firmware update for their high-end projectors. If you've gone and splashed big bucks on one of their projectors, you're getting a firmware update.
Yeah, you are. I mean, Frame Adapt 2 is coming out, and they're, again, improving on something which was also, already very, very good. And it's, it's a free update. I mean, all owners of the NZ series are just, should be cheering about this, because once again, their machines are not being made obsolete overnight by the announcement of a new model, and they're being improved for free. So I just love what they've done there with that commitment to existing users.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think other manufacturers could take a leaf out of that and offer that. We don't need new products every year.
Well, there was a time, wasn't there, Phil, where they would release the firmware onto and announce a new model, and the only difference was that the new model had this firmware
had it already loaded.
And,
yeah,
yeah, and they do an annual update like that, which was an absolute pain. But
it's you know, maybe Ed will come in on this one. Ed's been all around both sides of the fence. So what's your thoughts on that, Ed? Product cycles and firmware updates, now that that can be done, do you think that manufacturers should be taking the foot off the gas a little bit?
Yeah, we're charging people as much as we're now charging people for a lot of these products, the audacity to give them anything less than the longest lifespan you can reasonably attain. I mean, if there's a credible reason based around hardware that you physically have to change something, that's a different argument. But we are in a period of relative technical stability in both two-channel and AV at the moment. And you can't, I mean, you know, this is what brought AV, you know, down from a period of being almost all-conquering, is that if you repeatedly tell people that their stuff is obsolete and then with that it's worth very little and you have to buy a complete new set of stuff, eventually they go, no, I'm not going to do that. And, you know, it caused a number of problems. And at the higher end especially, you need stability, you need longevity, you need people to have the confidence that when they're putting down a serious sum of money, that the product that they buy is going to be viable, supported and contemporary for as long as that's practical to do.
Yeah. I mean, you don't get it in many other industries. I mean, I'm thinking cars, you know, new cars. Models of cars tend to stick around a long time. You get the facelift, but normally, you know, if you go and buy a new car, Ed, you're going to get 4 or 5 years before the facelift it, but it'll still be the same model. They just change the design slightly. And if there is any advances in tech, then that's when they add it in. So, you know, I'm not suggesting that manufacturers take 4 years to replace a TV, but every year, they have to have these new models, and perhaps it's not really necessary. Maybe we should go back, Jules, to the old model. And Martin, you'll remember the old model, which was you had manufacturers like Denon, Pioneer, Onkyo, and so on. They would have their set range, I'll say mass market range, but then they had their flagships. They had their big amplifiers like Susano, which is Pioneer's big flagship. You had the Denon A1C, or it was AV1C, the big Denon from about a decade ago. You know, and a lot of R&D went into these products, and they were expected to be the product for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And they were substantial bits of kit, those. It would have been, I would think, devastating for any owners of those to have to chuck those away, but that's inevitably what happened. There was actually an interesting release a couple of years ago on, actually going back to video devices, but on the Epson TW9400, they included quite substantial changes to the optics and to the iris through, I think it was firmware 1.03, and the image got quite substantially better after that update. There was some rumor online that they'd included a third pixel position, which actually turned out not to be the case, and there were articles written about it online, so I don't know where that came from, but there were definite improvements to the image as time went on.
Yeah, and again, Ed, it gives manufacturers, you know, once it's out in the wild and you start getting the feedback, it's something that we do on a regular basis. We're looking at the products usually a little bit ahead of time before they actually hit the mass market. And those products can change quite substantially from when we review them and give our feedback to the manufacturer to maybe 6 months down the line.
Yeah, I mean, there's the arguments for longer product cycles, and this is even before we touch on environmental aspects, I just think they're getting too strong to ignore. And it's, I bet you that if you put senior figures from each of the major screen manufacturers in a room together and you plied them with sodium pentothal or scotch, you know, you choose your poison, you just get, they're essentially waiting for one of them to break first. And the moment that one of them does, I bet you that they all do. Yeah. But for as long as they're locked into this pointless cycle of changing every year, there's nothing they can do about it. So,
yeah. So if you've got thoughts on this, listener, our view. And you know, you've gone out and you've dropped some serious coin and then found that your model 6 or 12 months later is kind of out of date in terms of the manufacturer's lineup. What's your thoughts on that? Do you think we should be extending the product lineup and the product time? Give us your thoughts. Podcast at avforums.com is the email. The chat window is open. We'll see if there's any comments in there before we leave tonight. And of course, find the podcast on the podcast forum on AV Forum and leave your comments in there. And this is exactly what we're doing now. We're reading back through a lot of these comments. So Chester, who's a Navy Forums member, he makes a good point, Ed, and I think this is one maybe for you to take, because he's aiming it towards stereo and surround sound. But I think in the stereo world, where traditionally there's been a lot of snake oil, sometimes valuable products get lobbed in with this snake oil phrase, especially yes. Mains conditioning. So maybe you can read his question and then give your thoughts on it.
Yes. Another idea for the podcast, if I may, something for both stereo multi-channel enthusiasts, power, the design, installation, do's and don'ts, mains conditioning, and for those that might think this is just snake oil, talking about some of the problems that we may encounter that are measurable or worthwhile improvements a good installation or components can make. Yeah, it's something that I've avoided going anywhere near because obviously AV Forums is a varied church of individuals, and there are some people that take mortal offence at the discussion of any of these products, like why can't the manufacturer do it, why doesn't it have the effect on my fridge, the standard tropes. I've been doing this with, being a member for 20 years, you've seen it all. The catch is any approach to this has to take into account that the variability of how effective various measures are, be they fixed components or actual tweaks and changes that can be made by a qualified electrician, I am at pains to stress, not you, to your house, is going to vary depending on what you've got connected, what you've got around you, and other considerations of that nature. But nevertheless, I did see this crop up this morning, and I will summon up my mental fortitude and speak to Phil, who of course is the editor, about where we might take such a thing, whether we might want to do an art, article piece first and so on and so forth, or whether we want to get stuck in and have a look at a few sort of treatment options from not a lot of money through to, oh my word, that's a great deal of money indeed. Mm. So we'll see where we want to go on that. And I welcome any feedback in the comments section as to whether, I have to admit, if we move into a DIY, once again, for the benefit of everyone listening, it is not DIY unless you are a qualified electrician. In terms of physical modifications to your mains, there's a huge amount to cover. There are some potential benefits, but it's very niche and there will be a fair degree of variability to what's going on. So I'm welcome to comments and we'll see what we can do. But yes, it comes fraught with a few different risks, so we need to approach it carefully.
I think the reason for that is over the years, there has been mixed messages when it comes to this kind of thing, and it doesn't help that back in the day you used to get reviews that said, oh, the video processing improved on my TV because I added a mains conditioner. I mean, these things are just impossible. It's not a video processor you've just added in, it's a mains conditioner. But there are reasons to have devices like that, to have four ways that have surge protection, have mains conditioning built in and so on. So, yeah, I think it's something that perhaps needs to be revisited, Ed, and look at it again without, on the back of reviews that make no sense whatsoever, because it will not enhance the quality of your sound quality or your video quality or whatever, but it will help in other areas. Mm. Right, let's move this on because I realize we are spending a little bit of time on this, but Panasonic TVs again on YouTube, there's comments about attached power cords. Again, this is it seems to really annoy people, and it's something, as a reviewer, sometimes you forget, we're not living with these products over many years. If we're lucky, we get 6 months with a product, or I get 6 months with a certain TV, and then it goes back. But power cords, there's something to be said about ones that are attached to the TV and you can't move if you're going to wall mount and so on, opposed to figure of eight or kettle lead, approaches, that kind of thing, duals. You're out in the field, you see how people set up their TVs and where they place them and so on. Is there something to be said for TVs that have detachable power cords, so you can replace it with a longer one or a shorter one, or you know, do we just put up with the manufacturer saying do not touch this because it's hardwired in?
I don't know if it's ever come up, but Phil, I don't think anybody's grumbled to me. You know, they've already had their TVs set up in place and they've worked around it, whatever problems there might be. But and the ability to use your own power cord would be, I guess, you know, just, you know, better. You know, got more flexibility, positioning. Not everybody's got sockets in the where you desirably need them. I guess those who are into the whole sort of cables making a big difference thing can buy a very expensive power cable. You know,
a mains lead that costs more than the TV. But when did it change? Because all of my plasmas had IEC sockets and detachable mains leads. And then the OLED, or both of the OLEDs that have turned up, do not. And it's like there was a sudden industry-wide step change on this.
Some of them still do. Some of the TVs, so Samsung still do detachable cables and so on. Panasonic are hardwired, LG are hardwired. I believe Sony allow you to use a detachable in some of the higher-end models. So it seems to vary from manufacturer to manufacturer, but I didn't realize it was such a big issue for people until it's obviously been pointed out. And you know, some people obviously take a great deal of dissatisfaction that they can't have their own power cable. So moving on quick then, Ed, I think this next one's for you.
Is it?
Or no, I think it was you, Martin, that reviewed the Primair, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Alan Nasser Jaipur 3275 reckons Primair truly gives value for money and punches way over its price point. The same can be said about their other products. I haven't had much exposure to their other products, but certainly the A35.8 that I reviewed seemed very good value for money at £4,500. Many 8-channel Class D amplifiers are north of 6,000. You can go, the sky's the limit. But yes, it does seem to be a very well-priced piece of kit. Certainly that was.
Excellent. Good stuff. Well, we've answered all the questions. And like I say, if you want your questions answered, you want to go into things in a little bit more detail, then leave a discussion. Go to the discussion thread on EV Forums. It's in the podcast forum, right at the bottom of the forums. Go in there, find this podcast, add your question in there. Or, of course, we're on YouTube. If you're watching on YouTube, there is the discussion thread on there in the comments. So add your comments in there. And I know that Andy does trawl through and he will pick out the questions and make sure that we answer them on the next podcast. So please do that. Right. So before we get into tonight's show, we just need to quickly catch up because it's been a month. What have everybody been doing? Ian, did you get out of the house in the month?
Not really. I made the very bad decision at the beginning about 6 weeks ago to start replaying Elden Ring, which is like one of the biggest, longest, never-ending games around. And then couple of days ago or last week Starfield came out, which is one of the biggest games of the year, both
literally. Elden Ring in space.
Yeah, well yeah, a bit of, and it's just I don't have time for anything else, but this, I've got planets to save, things to do, so yeah, busy
systems,
yeah.
To jet wash, etc.
yeah it's the kind of game. Yesterday I had kind of a bit of a plan for what I was going to do on it, and then I just saw as a little activity at the bottom of my mission list that said speak to Kevin. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know who Kevin was, but I went and found him. And then I spent the whole day doing stuff, just from the simple discussion with a guy called Kevin, bumped into three other people on the way. And I was, that was me done for the day. I achieved nothing, but I had good fun doing it.
Crikey. Okay. Martin, what have you been up to?
Just had a week in Edinburgh on family business, but 3 weekends ago, I was at the 1980s festival known as Rewind. And Rewind South takes place in Henley-on-Thames, where I live. And I review that every year for the local paper and also do a few interviews with artists. And this year I did interviews with Nick Kershaw and Toya Wilcox. And quite interestingly, the Art of Noise, who were fascinating to talk to, their work with Trevor Horn, etc. And that's an era that I'm very interested in. So it's a fun to go to and fun to write about.
Excellent. I always try and do the 80s thing, the tour around the country every June and July. And unfortunately, I was away doing other things the weekend it was on. In fact, I think it was the same weekend there was the Pink concert and there was some other big concert locally, and it was just an absolute nightmare to try and get anywhere. So, but yeah, I try and do that every year because you get some great bands, some great lineups. And on the back of those, I've gone and seen the bands again. So like OMD, Human League, you know, all those big bands for the 80s. They're fantastic what they're doing.
And it's just a really fun event and very good natured and very friendly. And I love going to it. Really enjoy it.
Yeah, good stuff. Jules, I believe you've been in Dracula country.
I have,
And not Transylvania.
Well, you know, we've been on for a week in Whitby and made sure that the night before we watched The Last Voyage of the Demeter, which just come out on the Kaleidoscope. So we watched that and appropriately set the scene. But although it wasn't, I mean, I believe the rest of you had a heat wave because in Whitby, it was nice, but it wasn't too hot. It was, you know, low 20s. 20, 21, 22. Very nice. Fairly cool weather. And it certainly wasn't like the opening scene in The Last Voyage of the Demeter.
Yeah. It's a cracking town. If people haven't been, absolutely go. It is beautiful. It's a really nice place. We regularly go on car runs and stuff down that way. Park up at the Abbey for lunch a lot of the times. You know, we'll take a park lunch and park up there and you get a whole view of the whole town. If you take the stairs down into the town, it's fantastic.
199 steps, I believe.
Yep.
Although I counted them and it was 204. So I don't know how I ended up with 204 and there's actually 199.
But did you have a nice holiday? That's amazing.
Yeah, it was lovely. You spend the week away trying to feel like you're on holiday and not thinking about work. And then when you come back, you realize, actually, what a good time you've had, though you didn't realize it so much at the time. It was lovely, very nice,
good stuff. I'm off to Skye next week, so by the time we come back on the podcast, I shall have been there, and it's not looking great at the minute. It looks like it's going to rain all the time, but never mind. It's a
how are you getting there?
I'm taking the Mustang.
Oh,
so
nice.
Fingers crossed it gets there and back. But yeah, so I've been a few times. And it's a beautiful part of the country. Really nice. Recommend that as well. So what have I done? Well, yesterday was a Great North Run up here, and my other half was running in it. I'm going to put my name down and do it next year. It was a fantastic day. Sun was out. Red arrows were out over the start line. And then I made my way over to South Shields for the finish line. And the Red Arrows did it must have been a 15-minute display. It was absolutely fantastic, right over the seafront. And then I was waiting on the other half coming in. She just crossed the line at 3:15 and the heavens opened. And I mean, I've never been as wet in my life, absolutely drenched. And of course, everybody then runs for their cars. We were parked on the grass in a grass field. There was a month's worth of rain within 15 minutes. You can imagine the chaos that ensued. We got home. She finished at 3:15. We were back at the car 3:30. 20 to 4, and we didn't get home till 9:30 last night. So that tells you how long it took us. It was the same for everybody. The streets were flooded. The metro system was flooded. The ferries didn't run. The roads were absolutely mayhem. So yeah, Great North Run, excellent event. But it opened up. And then the other thing was we did the Borders Run with the Mustangs. So. I think Stuart's got the video running for those watching on YouTube. Good turnout of cars. We had 17 cars this time. We went from Northumbria all the way up into the Scottish borders. We stayed in a little village called Denham for 90 minutes. We put the cars on the village green so people could see them. And then we ended up back at a coffee house for cake and coffee at the end of it. So it was great. And we got fantastic weather as well. So, yeah, good time had by all. So we're all caught up. Current competition, we've got some massive, massive competitions at the moment. Ian hasn't said much at the minute. So Ian's going to take us through these competitions because we have an enormous sum of money when you add them all together. So tell us all about them, Ian.
Yeah, okay. I'll try to be quick. First of all, we've partnered with Blue Sound to celebrate its 10th anniversary with a giveaway of its special edition Nodex wireless high-res multi-room music streamer. which got a value of £699. That has a closing date of Sunday the 17th of September, just before midnight. So if you're watching or listening to this a little bit later, you might have to move fast to get your name in the hat for that one. Similarly, there's a Valencia Tuscany Black Cinema seat worth £1,399 on offer, courtesy of Valencia Home Theatre Seating. That's only open until 11:59pm on Wednesday the 13th of September. So if you're not listening to this live, you might have to move very, very quickly to get your name in the hat for that one. Moving on, we've got £500 that you can win to spend with MPB, the platform for selling and trading used photo and videographic equipment. You've got until the 29th of September to get in there, to enter that one, so a little bit of time to play with there. Elsewhere, we've partnered with Peter Tyson. You can win a pair of Bowers & Wilkins 607 S3 bookshelf speakers, along with an AudioQuest Rocket 11 speaker cable, which is worth a combined total of £999. £919, sorry. Don't want to overprice the products too much. And we've also partnered with AV.com, so you can win a complete monitor audio and Roxanne hi-fi system worth £2,468 from AV.com. That includes a pair of Monitor Audio Bronze 500 floor-standing speakers, a Roxanne Atessa integrated amplifier, and a Visual cable pack. You've got until October for that one, so a little bit of time to get your name in that. And it all adds up to a total prize pool, which is worth £5,968, which makes me ask whether I am allowed to enter them all. And
yes, so yeah, I'm the only one that's not.
Check with my eBay account. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, get yourselves entered into that one. Bowers & Wilkins 600 series, they've just been released. So that is a fresh box there, those speakers. Ed, we've got them lined up for review, have we?
Yes, there's 606s on running at the moment in the other room. So, yes, excellent. They will be in the next tranche of reviews.
Yeah, and AV.com got a fantastic hi-fi system in there as well. So, yeah, some great prizes there. Home cinema seat as well, and the Node X. So, yeah, get yourselves in there. 500 quid to spend on camera gear. I'd have that spent in a second. Right, what else is there, Ian?
We also have some exclusive offers for patrons, which, as you might expect, includes a lot of Blu-ray discs. We have modern horror classic It Follows on limited edition 4K Ultra HD. David Cronenberg's Crime of the Future on limited edition 4K Ultra HD. There's also Fast X on 4K Blu-ray. You can also win three British comedies, which is Passionate Stranger, The Truth About Women, and Rattle of a Simple Man by the trailblazing Muriel Box. That's also on Blu-ray. Wes Anderson's Asteroid City is also available on limited edition Blu-ray. You get The Flash on Blu-ray, you can win that. And there's also a selection of our top 10 recommended UK Blu-rays for September, which currently includes the likes of The Ship That Died of Shame, Blazing Magnum, and The Antichrist. So to be in with a shout of winning all those discs and all the aforementioned prizes, head over to avforums.com/competitions to enter. All competitions are open to eligible AV Forums members or patrons resident in the UK.
Excellent. And Jules, why don't you tell us who the previous hardware competition winner was?
I will do indeed. Hold on, let me just find the bit where we are. The previous competition winners, Ultra 2 Man, won a Humax A1 4K Ultra HD streaming box. And is that three Humax Wi-Fi smart plugs bundle?
Yep. Looks like it. So three plugs and the streaming box in the bundle from Humax. So well done. Ultra 2 Man, I take it that's THX Ultra 2 Man. Yeah, and we got a new patron, and that's Colin. Oh, actually, we've got a few new patrons. So Ian, why don't you tell us who the new patrons are?
Yeah, it looks like we've got three, unless the fourth one's just a blank box.
This is the artist formerly known as.
Three new patrons. Welcome aboard to Colin McPhee, Sebastian Corfanti, and DRT.
DRT's up there twice as well, so well done, DRT. Thank you very much for your support, guys. It really is appreciated. Any support you give us does help us improve the podcast. We'll maybe do a good one day with your support. But anyway, let's get on with the show. So we'll move on to TV, but we're going to be quite quick with TV this week because the reviews are already published. So you can go and read the review, or you can go and watch the review on our YouTube channel. And I'll tell you what we've got coming up for review TV and display wise as well. But there was a big TCL announcement, Ian, not that long ago, 29th of August, in the run up to IFA, which wasn't as big a show as it has been in previous years. It's still going, but it seems to be fighting to stay relevant. But TCL, they revealed their flagship TV, so tell us about them.
Yeah, basically, they'd already announced part of the range early in the year, but they unveiled three new mini-LED TVs, all with quantum dot technology and all coming in sizes up to 98 inches. So these are quite literally a big deal. Headline act was probably the X955, boasting what it's calling dual 5000 technology, which basically means it comes with a peak brightness of 5000 nits and more than 5000 full array local dimming zone. And that's available in at least 85 and 98 inch models, which have been confirmed, and possibly smaller sizes to come. Definitely coming this year, with October the expected window. They've also announced the new C955 upgrade over last year's C935. That's offering up to 2000 nits peak brightness and 2000 plus dimming zones, and that will be available in sizes from 65 to 98 inches. Plus, there's also a new entry-level QD mini-LED in the form of the C805, which is designed to offer something of a bridge down to TCL C745 QLED TV. That also offers up a 98-inch option, but also smaller screen sizes down to 50 inches with peak brightness of 1,300 nits and around 500 dimming zones, or up to 5,500 dimming zones, sorry. And obviously all of the usual TCL features, so there's Dolby Vision, Dolby Atmos, 144 hertz, variable refresh rates, and so on. In terms of pricing, it's nothing confirmed for the UK as yet, but I have seen some potential European figures being reported. With the X955, for example, has been quoted at €4,999 for the 85-inch, up to €7,999 for the 98-inch, which, as a rough conversion to pounds and rounded up for simplicity, is about £4,299 versus £6,999. Same size, C955 is at €3,999 versus €5,999. With the C805 reportedly set to start around €999 for the 50-inch to €4,999 for that big 98-inch version. So, yeah, very serious prices, but some very serious TVs possibly coming from TCL in the near future.
Yeah, like Samsung and LG before them, TCL Hisense are definitely, they've done the number crunching, they've done the disruptive stuff in the marketplace to get their names known, they've done the big sponsorship deals. TCL with the NFL, Hisense do the soccer, as they say in the US. So world football, the World Cup, as well as the Euros. So yeah, they've spent big. They've cut slash prices. They've been disruptive. Now they're bringing in the flagship models, Jules. Some of these are pretty big screen sizes and some big numbers. Yeah,
Right. I've seen comments on various forums, not the AV forums. About this being way too bright, how eye searingly bright do a TV's going to get, and 5000 nits is too much, and if it's brighter than my plasma, it's too bright. Comments on that,
doesn't work like that.
No,
does it?
That is not how it works.
That's not the point of HDR.
Exactly. Yeah, so we're not talking average picture level being 5000 nits. We're talking about peak highlights, aren't we? And being more reflective of what we see naturally with our human visual system. But it's some way off 5,000 nits.
It's good that you mentioned the word reflective, because this is where I think it makes sense for a lot of people. If you think about how we actually see the world and what we're actually trying to achieve with high dynamic range images, is that we're trying to achieve something that's lifelike. And this is, I saw a 10,000 nit Sony display at CES a number of years ago, and you get the comments, oh, that must have been too bright and so on. No, it's the most realistic image I have ever seen in my life. There was a Camaro, a 68 Camaro, under hotel lights, hotel lobby lights. It had been filmed in HDR at 10,000 nits mastered, and it looked like you were standing next to this thing, looking on this display. It was utterly convincing, and this is what HDR is all about. It's about being in a dark room with a bright window and being able to make out what's outside in detail without it clipping all the detail out, but seeing what's inside this dark room as well, and having that juxtaposition of the brightness but being able to see the detail, because your eyes can do that. Yeah. And this is what high dynamic range is about. So when you're saying 5,000 nits peak brightness, you're not talking about a TV that is 5,000 nits bright. It's not that. It's like a tiny, tiny area, yeah, or a reflection on a bit of chrome on the screen, or, you know, it's a reflection on a window or whatever. It's these little touches that just add that realism in. And when you see it done properly, and I know that Joe sees this all the time because he works with professional grading monitors, which are designed so that the person grading can see it as it's intended. It's amazing when you see it done properly. Mm. The problem we have at the minute is that the vast majority of sets use tone mapping, which is trying, and this is one of the analogies I keep going back to, that's trying to get 5 pints of liquid into a 2-pint container. When you're talking about what TVs are capable at the moment and what the, you know, the mastered content could look like. And it's tone mapping. It's what it's throwing away to fit that within the capabilities of the displays at the minute. If you've got a projector, you ain't seeing HDR. It can say HDR on it. They can mark it as HDR. They can say it does frame adapting and all the rest of it. But it's still not HDR. It's incapable of that high dynamic range. So TCL really are knocking it out of the park with this display. I've yet to see it. I hope I will see it very soon. And if it can achieve that, because it's all right saying our display does 5,000 nits and it has 5,000 dimming zones, but if your algorithm is incapable of taking advantage of that technology, it's not going to look very good. So the big challenge is how they're actually going to drive this panel. How is the software going to adapt it and so on? So I didn't want to spend too much time on it because we're going to get Marek from TCL on a future podcast, hopefully before CES. If not, it will be straight after CES. And we are going to go through these models in some detail and get their ideology. What is it that TCL are trying to do? Because they've done the disruptive thing. Now they're heading into the flagship market. They've done a lot of research, R&D. We have printable OLED technology that's been touted around, shown as concept products, which looks fantastic as well. So, yeah, it's looking really, can I say the cliche? It's looking really bright for TCL's future. There we go. Right, so that's the TV news out of the way. I said it was going to be brief. I'm going to talk about the Panasonic MZ2000 very quickly as well, because I realize I've been doing a lot of talking tonight so far. But the review is up on AV Forums. It's still on the homepage. Go and have a look at that. It's a cracking TV. The problem is, at the minute, if you are not, or you do not have to buy a new TV this year, if your other TV hasn't broken yet, and you're not forced into a TV purchase, the Panasonic's a great TV, but I would hold off to next year's model. I know I gave it a highly recommended because it's worth that badge. It's worth the score that I've given it. The problem for it is it's come out too early. It's come out before the Pentonic chip is available. And that's why Sony are holding off for their flagship TVs, which are just coming to market now. And the problem with the Panasonic is the processing, the image processing, the dithering just above black. There's quite a bit of noise there. If you feed it low bit content, you are going to see a little bit in terms of floating blacks and flashing blacks, which has been a problem for the last two, maybe three generations of set jewels, this MediaTek. So it's been a slight issue. Now, we are nitpicking here, and I meant that pun. When it comes to these issues, but they are, you know, if you're spending this type of money, you want to get around these issues. And Panasonic have always been great with just above black detail, but the last three generations, including this 2000, have been a little bit disappointing. Another thing is posterization, Jules.
I was going to ask you about that, Phil. you noted that in your review that you were seeing a little bit of that.
Yeah, it's still there, around bright objects. If you get it over a certain brightness level, then you are seeing posterization around objects like the sun in the sky. There's a scene in the Meg where the camera's underwater, you've got the sun above and it breaks the water and the sun is posterized. There's no detail around there, unfortunately. Opening to Kingsman as well, which is a well-known demo. Showing off HDR content, again you've got posterization around the bright objects, so it's a shame that it's still there, because it's been there for, and I think the engineers are just not able with the hardware to get rid of that,
and no smooth gradation or equivalent.
There is no smooth gradation, which everybody's introduced this year apart from Panasonic, so I don't know what the thinking is behind that. I'm hoping to catch up with the engineers, hopefully CES, if not at their launch for the next range and get the up to date thinking behind it. But it's a fantastic TV. It's worth 9 out of 10. Is it worth the money? That's entirely up to you. I don't want to tell you what to buy or what you can afford to buy or whatever. If you think it's worth that, then great. It's a good purchase. But I think if it was me, I'd be holding off just to see what Panasonic can do with the Pentonic chips when they're available, and that'll probably be next year's lineup. If you're in the market a little bit lower, the sets are brilliant. You know, you're going to struggle to find anything better at certain price points. The problem for Panasonic, the problem from Sony, the problem for Philips, who are all doing WRGB TVs, and it's what I hinted at the start of the podcast, is LG. LG have got the market sewn up this year. C3 is an absolutely cracking TV. It's an all-rounder. It'll do gaming, 4 HDMI 2.1, lots of the G-Sync, and it's all there in this TV. Plus, the picture quality is great. Picture processing has improved a hell of a lot the last 2 years from LG. And then the G3, when you add in MLA, it's probably between it and the Samsung QD OLED at the moment, the S95C, which I have both of them sitting next to each other. I've been sitting watching them side by side for months now. It's hard to pick a winner, but if it helps, I'm sitting watching the LG G3 as my day-to-day TV. So maybe that tells you something. I don't know, but it's incredibly close this year. But the Panasonic, great effort from the team at Panasonic. I absolutely love the way that they do things. I love the fact that they basically take on everything that we say that makes up a great image, and they try to do that. So from that point of view, absolutely fantastic. If you were pushing me, I'd say wait to next year. If you're waiting to buy a TV, I'd say wait to next year, because I think we need things to settle a little bit. Now, that's my opinion. That might not be Jules's opinion, who gets to see these things in a different environment to me. So Jules, what's your thoughts?
Well, obviously can't speak about the MZ 2000 because I've not seen it yet, but I'd have to, you know, what I've seen so far, my preference would probably be for the LG G3, simply because it does have everything, you know. Yeah. Particularly if you're a gamer and you like a bit of HDR jet washing, and it does a fantastic job. It, you know, so you're not going to get a bad one. They're all absolutely cracking TVs, and there'll be maybe something about one TV that you prefer over the other, and might come down to the operating system.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I said, I didn't want to spend too much time because there is a video, there is the review up there. We've also got a settings video as well. So if you go and buy one, you want the best settings. And we've got a video up there showing you how to do that as well. Just quickly, upcoming TV and projector reviews from myself. I've got the TCL C745 on the test bench. I've also got the Hisense U8K, which is directly behind me at the moment. It's on the test bench. I'll get those done after my holiday, so end of the month for those two TVs. BenQ W4000i projector, I have reviewed that. Just need to get it written up. Done all the video stuff as well, so that should pop up within the next few days. And also the 4Movie UST projector, I've been playing around with that and having a look at that. It's a popular one on the forums. I'll give you my thoughts and the written review and a video very soon as well. So that's the things that I am working on at the time being. Just looking very quickly at the questions, just to see if there's any TV related ones. So the MZ 2077 inch does not have MLA technology, Michelle. So that could be an issue. Only the 55 and 65. That's all I can tell you about the 77 because I haven't seen it just yet. I've seen a prototype. Don't really like to comment on prototypes. I'd rather see a retail unit. It's not likely that's going to happen before the new year, so I can't really comment. But the 55, 65 have identical image quality. They have the same features and the same panel makeup. Halle asks, can we expect a review of the Panasonic MZ1500? Yes, end of the month, I'm expecting that sample to arrive, as well as the MX950, which is Panasonic's mini LED for the year. So really interested to see that because it's been a while since we've seen a top-end LCD TV from Panasonic. So yeah, looking forward to that. Those will be coming in to me at the end of the month, so look out for reviews in October for those. And Lee, he's gone on to the topic that we were discussing and Ed was on about as well in terms of technology and product cycles and all the rest of it. Lee says, is it not because technology is advancing quicker than years ago when you had to wait for many years to get better tech? Is it not a case that if they're late to market now with the technology, they kind of lose out, Ed?
The irony is we've seen exactly the opposite. You've just been going on about the fitment of this chip that Sony's hanging fire for. If you're absolutely plugged in to a rapid update life cycle, you'd get products out that actually don't have a feature that will benefit you. I would also say that we've had a period of tremendous technological change in the last few years. But if we're honest, I mean, I still use televisions from 2017 and 2018, and they do all of the things that they need to do. And whilst I'm sure that there are, you know, watchable improvements, if I rushed out and bought a 2023 set now, I don't feel that I'm missing out on anything that catastrophic at the moment, if I'm honest. So no, I agree with what you're saying, but the circumstances in which the market exists at the moment, it doesn't apply in that sense.
Okay, hopefully that answers that, Lee. Lai Hazelwood says Panasonic has the best TVs for home theater, and also Panasonic always improves the LG panel. Yeah, that's very true. They do. They take a proprietary heatsink system. It's a multi-layered heatsink system that they add to the LG's panel. They've also got their own processing and so on. The problem for Panasonic, unfortunately, is that everybody else is catching up. So what used to be Panasonic's, you know, sales hook, their niche, which was, you know, creators intent and having a fantastic image and you know, taking LG's panel and adding improvements and so on, the rest of the market, unfortunately for Panasonic, have caught up now and are catching up and are biting on the heels of Panasonic. And again, this is why I'm saying, if you don't have to buy a TV, maybe wait till next year, because I think that's when you're going to see what they can do with a very good silicon on chip solution, which is what they are lacking in at the minute, in my opinion. So that wraps up all the questions. That wraps up TV. We'll be back in a second with home cinema.
If you'd like to support the AV Forums podcast on a regular basis, then why not become a patron? Head over to patreon.com/AV Forums to sign up. You can also make a one-off donation through the Super Chat or via streamlabs.com/AV Forums. All donations help us to improve the website and the podcasts. Thank you to all our supporters.
Okay, so let's move on to some home AV news, home cinema side of things. So Ian, what have we got?
First up, we've got a couple of announcements from Denon, who have announced their first 8K stereo network receiver. It's called the DRA900H, and so it'll come as a little surprise to hear that it builds upon the existing DRA800H model, but obviously with that 8K video support through three of its six HDMI inputs. Delivers up to 145 watts output per channel and comes with a price tag of £799. As part of the same announcement, Denon also announced it's adding a new AVR to its X series lineup, with the AVR X1800H fitting in towards the cheaper end of the lineup at £699. That comes with a 7.2 channel setup that can also handle 8K video, along with Dolby Vision, HDR10, and a bunch more stuff. Along with a £699 price tag, if you want to add an extra £50 to that, you can upgrade to a version with a built-in DAB tuner as well.
Okay, let's come to Martin on this question. And Martin, is an AVR still relevant in today's marketplace with soundbars and multi-channel systems that can sit under the TV? Is the AVR dead at that price point, or is there still a market, do you think?
And powered speakers, that whole thing where people are decluttering. And yes, one has to ask that question. Of course, with a AVR, though, you do get all the added inputs, and there is more real estate within which to put lots of features for streaming and all that good stuff. So I guess there is some sense in it. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that we've even seen the stereo receiver become a thing in the hi-fi world as well, Ed. Isn't it fair to say it's a category that's kind of meeting AV again and almost casting back to the 1970s, and yet we have all that extra, all those extra goodies thrown in.
There are no new ideas under the sun, Martin. You know this.
Yeah, exactly.
And essentially, no, I think everything is cyclical. And yeah, the blurring point now between stereo amps with quite significant AV functionality, which, I mean, I wrote about this years ago. I don't want to sound smug, but yeah, I did the whole post AV sort of concept suddenly lurched into being. And yeah, the point where these things end and stereo amps begin, in many ways, actually, manufacturers have calmed down a bit, because there was a point where there were stereo receivers with, you know, quite significant HDMI functionality and so on and so forth. And it's actually, the market didn't take to those. So there's plenty of products I test with HDMI ARC and so on and so forth. And then there are AV receivers, and they seem to be separate, you know, they appear to be existing stable separate categories, and attempts to merge them have not proved 100%, you know, have not proved that successful, so they haven't pursued it. But yeah, the blurring is getting ever more so, and then it does mean that there's a squeeze on for categories like this. But you know, Denon obviously feels it's got another year in it, because here we go, we've got some more of them.
Well, the other flip of that coin is Marantz, Ian. Funnily enough, that was a nice segue into the product that they're launching.
Actually, Phil, one thing I would add as well, just anecdotally, I don't hear people talk about this sort of craving need for surround sound or 5.1 anymore. It's kind of almost left the vernacular in a way. And I think that's because, certainly for mainstream and high volume products, it tends to be now people talk about sound bars, and people don't really know what 5.1 is anymore.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And again, it's a subject for a more in-depth discussion on a podcast. But yes, you hit the nail bang on the head there, Martin. It definitely is the case. And it's interesting to see these markets develop and new markets, you know, take hold. And certainly the soundbar, the multi-channel soundbar and the powered speakers. I mean, I remember back on AV forums saying I was going to buy some Mackie studio monitors because they were actives, and you know, the amplification was matched to the drivers and so on, and it was like I'd slagged off somebody's granny, the reaction I got back then in terms of how dare you do that, and that's not home theater and all the rest of it. But you look at the marketplace now and it's a wash of active speakers. So so yeah, it's really interesting. And like I was going to say there, Ian, Marantz have certainly announced the Stereo 70, which looks like an interesting kind of hybrid.
Yeah, obviously it ticks a lot of the boxes that Mike mentioned earlier, both in terms of its name, in terms of being stereo, and, well, 70s or 70s. But yeah, it's a new compact two-channel model. It comes with a slimmer design than many others in the Marantz lineup, standing at just 11 centimetres higher, but it still packs in most of the company's latest technologies, such as the hyper dynamic amplifier modules and the same 8K support that we've been talking about a little bit earlier. It comes with Class AB amplification, delivering up to 75 watts per channel. And if it isn't already available by the time people are listening to this, it should be very, very soon, priced at £899.
Yeah, no, it looks like a really interesting product, that one, Martin. And, you know, I'm going to be moving house soon, and I'm looking at a nice little stereo system in a room where I can go and sit and read a book and maybe properly listen to it. And this kind of thing really appeals. It looks like it'll do a number of jobs for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, there is so much we can get on board these products now. It's just, yes, very versatile. And I think this is more the kind of thing that people are looking at. Yes, is reading a book, listening to some music, and not having, like I said earlier, too much clutter. And definitely there's a trend towards not having as much stuff around. I agree.
Yeah, and the boss, you just said, when have I got time to read a book? Well, I'd like to have time to read a book. I like to have a room just to go and chill out now and again and get away from screens and all the rest of it and just listen to some good music. And I'm kind of falling that way, and I can see why other people are in my demographic, in my age group. You know, the vinyl now appeals again, and actually sitting down and actually listening to something appeals again to me, because I think you get into the hectic side of things, you get into you know, multi-channel, you know, bangs and wallops and all this, and then just sometimes it's just nice to chill, just a nice bit of music, whether it's on vinyl or whatever, and just sit and relax. Jules, what's your thoughts on this end of the market and these products?
Well, like you, I don't get much time to sit and listen to things. I'd like to do that a bit more. Books for me are, I read a page before I fall asleep at night. But yeah, I think there is, speaking around with people I calibrate for and talk to, I think there is a growing interest in that again. Things became very convenient. I think the almost making listening to music again another event, you know, with the vinyl, with the two-channel stereo, it's I don't know what I'm reaching for here, apart from the fact that we've become too like consumerist, too instant, yeah. Too you know, and people want a bit more quality.
I know exactly what you're getting at, and I'm going to come to Ed on this one. So, Ed, are we talking about the fact that we should be getting off our fat arses, walking across and turning a record over and taking the time to even put that record on a deck and sit and listen to one side and then get up and turn it over and sit and listen to the other?
There is something to be said for the fact that it's the best way of actually enjoying an album, because there is not the temptation to mess around with a running order or things like that. Equally, I'm going to have a brief rant later on when we get to album of the month, that having been presented with this unbelievable opportunity, record labels are busy absolutely destroying it. But there is something to be said for equipment that does less and has you focus more on the things that it does. AV Forums is a wonderful place to review these things, because certain people are tremendously supportive of it in the comments. Other people who know the price of everything and perhaps less about the value of it will just say, no, it needs to have more bells, more whistles, more microphones, and so on and so forth. But the thing is that mercifully we have bits to cover. We have components to cover all areas of interest, and we try and review components to cover all areas of interest. But yes, I think we are heading back to a point where there's less fireworks, more emotion, and, you know, make of that what you will. It appears to be not something that is being, you know, it appears to be valid enough an idea that there's, you know, developments and equipment to back it up. So yeah, it looks that way.
Excellent. And just to wrap up on the news, Ian, some interesting power amplifiers from Lingdorf.
Yeah, this is kind of sliding up the scale a little bit. Lingdorf Audio has announced a new 8-channel power amplifier called the MXA 8400, which has been billed as its most powerful amplifier yet. The numbers behind this, that it delivers up to 400 watts per channel. It comes with Lingdorf's own PowerPerfect system to hopefully live up to its name. And the company has also once again teamed up with fellow Danes at Purify Audio to implement its EigenTAC technology to produce what looks like a very serious piece of kit designed to work in harmony with the likes of its MP4E and MP60 processors. It's due to arrive in November. It comes with a price tag of £7,999, but it does look very, very good.
Yeah, and I can't fault the Lingdorf processors, the MP40 and the MP60. I spent a lot of time with both of those processors cracking bits of kit. So to now have an amplifier, Martin, to go with those and to give you that many channels, it's a good move from Lingdorf, even at £8,000, you know, when you put it up with one of their processors, that's going to be a really nice sounding system.
Definitely. And this is highly, highly anticipated and highly sought after by Lingdorf devotees. Up until this point, only the 2400 was available, which was a two-channel amp. So anybody who had an entire Lingdorf system would have to have a rack of 2400 two-channel amps. So people have been, I think it was first teased about 4 years ago, and here we are, and it's finally here, the 8-channel. So I think this thing is going to sell like hotcakes.
Yeah.
And yes, and if the preamplifiers, MPs 40, 50, and 60 are anything to go by, I'm sure it will sound absolutely delightful and make the preamp sound as good or even better than they already are.
Yeah, I've never had a bad Lingdorf product. So yeah, that should be a cracker. Right, so let's move things on in the home cinema section. So Martin, we're coming to you for the Yamaha Advantage. Sorry, I can never say it right.
RX-8 I think it's
is that right? Is it okay? I had a look at the A6A. I think it was last year I looked at that, maybe even the year before. I think this line's been around a little while, but this is the baby of the range, or I think the two, A2 is actually the baby, but this is
actually
the one.
Actually, the A2A is the baby. This is, there are four in the range currently. A4A, which I looked at, A6A, A6A, which you looked at, and the A8A, which I believe is an 11 channel.
Yeah.
Receiver. The one you looked at is 9. This one is 7. I guess we describe this as a budget to mid-price receiver, 7 channels of amplification, 110 watts per channel with 2 channels driven. And again, no RMS figures, but they don't seem to share those these days with all channels driven.
Yeah, I think the best way to work that out these days is just look at the 2 channel driven and then assume that it's a quarter of that. And you're round about the right ballpark, aren't you, Ed?
It's something like that. And Yamaha, I mean, I don't want to single them out, but on occasions they've quoted power measurements on their website at 10% THD. Now, this is not the time for electron distortion, but I absolutely 100% promise you that you'll hear 10% total harmonic distortion. So it's an utterly meaningless figure. And yes, their figures are quite opaque, but yes, Mark, you're absolutely, both of you, on the mark. It's going to be quite a lot less than that once all 7 are hooked up and draining.
So if 7 ear level channels aren't an option for a 7.1 or 7.2 setup, you can of course do 5.2.2 or 5.1.2, which is actually how I wired this up with my M&K speakers as 5.2.2, so 150s at the front, 150Ts for surrounds, and actually 150s overhead as well, the MP150s, which are the slightly slimmer versions of the S150. The A4A's price at £1,599. I'll come on to that in just a moment. But I think this receiver is great for a beginner. You know, if somebody's got a budget of £5,000, you've got £2,000 there to spend on a great 5.1 speaker system or 5.1.2 speaker system. Comes with an excellent MusicCast app with all those multi-room possibilities thrown in. And actually, the app has quite a lot of tweakability for the inner workings of the receiver as well. So I think Yamaha's done well with the MusicCast. Lots of HDMI inputs, 7 of them. HDMI 2.1 with 40 gigabits per second. So pretty much future-proof. Audio comes, of course, with all the iterations of surround sound and immersive audio, DTS:X and Dolby Atmos, but no Auro 3D.
Before you go any further, we need to say goodbye to Jules, because Jules is away to play football. So, Jules, thank you very much for your time.
Yes, guys.
Catch you in the next one. Sorry to interrupt you there, Martin.
Martin.
We'll see you later, Jules.
Cheers, Jules.
Comes with Yamaha's famous Cinema DSP. In this case, it's called Cinema DSP HD3, and within which that sits the surround AI feature with a virtualizer, which can simulate the presence of other speakers. And actually, I found this worked extremely well. I did get this sense of, even though I was using 5.1.2, so everything was to the side or above me, I felt there was stuff going on behind me, and it really is very effective.
Yeah.
And, of course, the YPAO, it's not quite as sophisticated as a Dirac Live or something like that, but it uses 8 mic positions and gives a pretty good result at the end of it. I was quite pleased with it. And I'm sure you would concur with this, Phil, with the A6A. I thought dialogue intelligibility in real-world listening scenarios was excellent, actually quite crystalline. And what really surprised me was how good it was at steering objects and effects. It was really, really precise.
Yeah, no, very, very good. And it's interesting what you say about YPAO. It's something I'll leave switched off. Obviously, in a review, you test it just to see how much. But I always leave it off because it's not advanced enough. And I know my room so well now. That's going to change, obviously, when I move to a new one. But I've been in here nearly 20 years, and you know exactly how the room behaves and so on. Yeah, it's one of the weaker points. But like you say, in terms of sound quality, I've always been impressed with Yamaha. The Cinema DSP stuff, if you like that kind of thing, if you want to listen in a jazz club in Munich or whatever, then good on you. Go away, do it. It'll do that thing, whether you agree with it or not.
That's been in their processors since
it has. The first A1 that I had, DSP A1, it had all of those. And it was great back then. It was fantastic. I think we're a little bit more advanced these days, and you know, our tastes have changed quite a bit. But it's nice still to have that in there. And like you say, Surround AI is very, very clever. Yeah. And the virtual speakers are very, very clever. You know, manufacturers have all got their own little version of this, but yeah, it's clever technology in there.
I found the musical character slightly trebly. I'm not quite sure why that was, if that's okay. My room or whatever. It wasn't a sibilance or a shrillness, but a little on the trebly side. Worth bearing in mind as far as the competition, because I did not put any alternatives within the price range or the category, but it is, and this was highlighted by Nobler on the forum, that the Denon ABC X3800H has, of course, 9 channels of amplification and costs £200 less. So yeah, that is worth bearing in mind. I also find the current slate of Yamaha receivers to look a little cheap on the front, and I didn't like the small front panel display either. I think the Denons still try to emulate what used to look like good quality hi-fi. Yamaha has kind of steered quite away from that, I think.
I think we're kind of guilty of this, Ed, aren't we? Because sometimes we say, I wish AV manufacturers would take a little bit of a chance with design and change up the traditional, you know, screen in the middle and the dials left.
And then we hate it when they do.
And then we hate it when they do.
No, and I still haven't forgiven them for getting rid of orange displays. So no, with AV receivers in particular, you are 100% downed if you do and downed if you don't.
Yeah.
So I have enormous sympathy for the house AV brands and how they move the most reactionary design group imaginable in any direction at all. Yeah. I don't think that anyone has made a beautiful AV receiver in a very, very long time. That is the reality of it. I think I'm going to show my age here. The last good looking AV receiver was the Marantz SR12, and that's 20 years ago. So yeah, it's been a while. It's just one of those things. I'd suggest a rack which it vents well at the back and is covered at the front, and
yeah,
you can control these things by apps. You don't need IR line of sight. Just hide the damn thing away because it's hideous.
Yeah. Anyway, Martin's review of the A4A from Yamaha. It is up on AV forums. Go have a read if you want to get a little bit more in depth with Martin's thoughts on that receiver. They've always been a strong brand, Yamaha. They've been around forever. They were right at the start of the whole Dolby Pro Logic movement back in the day when I first got into this hobby back in the early 90s, and they've been strong ever since. They've always been around,
and they have all that pro prowess, you know. They make
the one thing is they make instruments, so they should know what instruments sound like, so you know that. That's always been a strong point for them. They also make motorbikes, and they know what motorbikes should sound like as well. It's always the other one. Right, but anyway, I think that wraps up Home AV for this week. We're going to move to Hi-Fi next.
If you enjoy the podcast on YouTube, then please like and subscribe. If you're listening to the audio version, then please leave us a rating on your podcast app. We invite you to email questions and feedback to podcast@avforums.com. And join in with this episode's discussion thread in the podcasts forum at AV Forums.
Right then, Phil's going to have some time out to himself. This won't be too long, but some hi-fi stuff. We're going to kick off with some news. First of all, we've got some new Bose and Wilkins speakers. Now, you sort of know this because you can win some of them if you scroll back to the beginning of this and look at the competitions. But nevertheless, there's more than just the ones you can win, and Ian is going to give us a quick overview on those.
Yeah, as very much given away earlier on in the podcast, the latest Bose and Wilkins speakers to get the upgrade treatment are the 600 series, which is getting a new and improved S3 lineup. Most of the upgrades trickle down from the 700 series with the likes of a new 25mm titanium tweeter, a new elongated tube loading system, and a new motor assembly that supposedly delivers more power and lower distortion. The range comes in at the more affordable end of the company's portfolio and is made up of the 603 S3 floor standards, which are priced at £1,999 a pair, along with a choice of 606 and 607 S3 bookshelves, which are priced at £749 and £599 respectively. And they also come with optional floor stands for an extra £279. And the lineup wraps up with the HTM6 S3 center channel, which is priced at £649. And if you want to buy them all in a bundle, there is 600 series S3 Theatre 5.1 package also available, which comes with the 607 bookshelves, along with the Bowers & Wilkins ASW 610 subwoofer for a combined price of £3,947.
Yeah, I've I went down to a launch event a little bit of time ago, and it was quite interesting because Andy Kerr, Bowers & Wilkins, he always does a good presentation, does Andy? And the most interesting thing is how much work has gone on based upon the principle that they were very, very keen not to increase the price beyond a fairly limited amount, given the current nature of things. So it's all been about looking at things. How do we do this better? If you've got a budget, if we can give you an extra dollar here, what can you do? And so on and so forth. And it sounds all a bit, oh, incremental gains. It's going to be a bit different, but, you know, same old, same old. And I have to be honest, when I listened to them in the event, I thought, well, this is all perfectly pleasant. I've got the 606 at home at the moment. They will be going through for test. And I'm genuinely impressed. That's all I want to say at this point. The developments might be incremental. The gain in what this is doing over the preceding 606 is not. So that's quite a surprise. And I'm looking forward to digging a bit further into that. So, there will be that coming through. And then I'm sure that one of the AV chaps will get the multi-channel in and have a good play about with that as well. If all this is a bit cheap for you, though, Ian, Fine Audio's got something a bit more fruity available.
Yes, yeah, it doesn't quite hit the heights of some of the things that we've done in the past, but yeah, it's very much up there. And it's actually one of the more affordable models in their range as well.
Yes.
Says quite a lot about the rest of their line. but what they've done is they've added a slightly smaller floor standing speaker option to its F1 series with the launch of the F1 8S. As the name suggests, it comes with an 8-inch isoflare driver, which is obviously smaller than its 10S and 12S counterparts. But it still uses the same 25mm magnesium tweeter, plus Fine's in-house technologies, Fine Flute Roll Surround and bass tracks to deal with those low frequencies. And yeah, that price tag is £12,999 per pair, which still isn't exactly cheap, but it is half the price of the 10S and a third of that of the 12S.
Yes.
Which just maybe helps to bring the F1 series a little more within reach for those who like the finer things in life.
Oh, I see what you did there. No, this should be an excellent loudspeaker. I mean, it's obviously in relatively recent history, we did the Classic 8, which is actually larger than this and less money. But Fine Audio, whatever they're putting in the tea up there at the moment, is yielding some good results. I don't consider this to be a tremendously beautiful loudspeaker. I can't shake the fact that it looks ever so slightly like it's made out of plumbing fixtures, but it is extremely well made, and I have every suspicion that it will sound absolutely fantastic. So yes, that's going through. I don't know if we're going to rush out and review a £13,000 loudspeaker. If we do, it might not be this one, but nevertheless, I have every suspicion it's going to be rather good. Those are the news stories that I felt were worth flagging. I'm going to very briefly talk about an upcoming review, which has gone into the content management system. So it will go up at a time of Phil's choosing. This is Name's 222 preamplifier and 250 power amplifier, which is part of their new Classic series of products. The reason I wanted to talk about them very quickly is not to do with the sound quality. I've done all that in the review. This is, for really rather different reasons, a bit of a step change in audio equipment, certainly in the time I've been doing this. The reason for that is the way that they look, that they feel, the way that they come out of the box, the manner in which you connect them up and they get up and running. It is one of the first times I can recall in a very long time where I tested a piece of, you know, high-end equipment. There's no getting around this. The pair of them are £11,400. I'm not going to insult anyone's intelligence and say that's anything other than an enormous sum of money. But, and you'll have to take my comments with a pinch of salt, they do genuinely feel of a nature where you can feel where some of that, a good proportion of that money has gone. They are exquisite to use. They are exquisite to look at. They do a vast variety of things, and they do it exceptionally well. It's a bit of a BCAD moment in terms of testing, because it sort of demonstrates what is technically possible. And I'm not necessarily talking about the bells and whistles of the specification. That's perfectly in line with what the market does. It's not actually a standout, but it's not about punching numbers on a spec sheet. It is the feel of these devices, and how, if you have them in your house and you invite someone who has no interest in audio round at all, I'd sort of point this out in the conclusion. All too often you'll show the stuff off and they'll give you that special pity face where it's people showing off their expensive hobby item. And, you know, they look at you, go, yeah, that's great. And if you were showing them a fishing rod, they go, yeah, that's great as well. And so on and so forth. This is one of those examples of something where it just feels commensurate with proper luxury goods being sold at big boy prices by big boy organizations. And I think that's very special, and I think that's very important. The full review will be up on the site in due course. It's 3,000 odd words, so we cover a lot of stuff. Unsurprisingly, you may not be staggered to learn that they do quite well in the review sense, but it's more a case that this is something a bit more than a piece of high-end audio equipment. And I think that that's hopefully something we're going to see a bit more of going forward, because we need to be a bit less parochial about these things. And I'd argue actually that the TV people and to a lesser extent the projector people have had a better understanding of the creation of something which feels like a luxury good, because simply bolting something together well does not automatically make it feel luxurious. And NAME has absolutely nailed this as a concept, and I'm hoping that more people start to pay attention to this as something to do going forward.
Ed, I just want to obviously move on from the name, because I want to go back to Bowers & Wilkins, the 600 series. And again, what we were talking about at the beginning of the podcast, you know, products that have a long product life or a long product cycle. And I was thinking back to when I had my first serious AV system in the early 90s. And it was Bowers & Wilkins 600 series speakers that I plumped for, with the yellow Kevlar drivers, if you remember them.
And rightly so, yeah.
And, you know, we're now another 23 years on, and we've still got the 600 series. They have been improved. They've got, I'm assuming it's the Continuum drivers that's in
this box. Oh, yes, Continuum. And they've been trickling stuff down, as Ian says. So there's little neat leap things, like they now have the same laid out terminal panels as the more expensive speakers, and it looks a damn sight smarter than what it used to, and it's a damn sight easier to use. But yes, you're absolutely right, Phil. There was a 607 back then and a 606 back then. There were other ones that have since fallen by the wayside, but the product has changed. Every single component has changed, but the linearity of what has been in production in that time has not. It has been a continuous process.
Yeah, it's a real Traeger's broom.
Yeah. And it inspires you to think, well, okay, it will be changed sooner or later, but, you know, this is it's a fixture. And, you know, it's the Golf GTI effect. You know, you can build the best hot hatch you like, but when it comes down to it, you've still got to convince people to not go for the one that's been around since the beginning. So they do that very effectively. But then, more interestingly, this generation appears to be quite a significant step forward in performance terms as well. So, yes, it's good news all around. Excuse me a second.
That's something I did notice with the 700s, the S3s, compared to the S2. And Andy did side-by-side comparisons for me in their demo room.
Yeah.
Now, there is you know, a few minutes between swapping the speakers out and putting the new speakers in. So it's not like an instant AB. But the thing I did notice there was just how much wider the soundstage was and how much more detailed it was on the new speaker, which was thinner and taller, and there was less space between the driver and the edge of the cabinet, and it had the nice little bow to the front of the cabinet now. And it's just little touches like that where you think, oh, they've just added that for design, and it's not always for design's sake. So it's interesting that they look very similar to what I had 23 years ago, but boy, the technology certainly moves on, doesn't it?
No, absolutely. And it does look like they've managed to achieve something very similar with the 606, certainly, and I suspect much the rest of the range. But yeah, 606 review will be churned out. I'd love to say for the end of the month, but Phil and I both know that that is a lie. I generally get most things in by about the 5th or the 6th of next month. So that'll be
5th or 6th October, and maybe add another week onto that, and we'll be in the right ballpark.
Yeah, that's what we're shooting for on this. This leaves us with, my Google Docs is just busy reloading. This just briefly, upcoming 8 hi-fi reviews. In terms of things that went in at the same time as the name, more WIM streamers, because the WIM Mini has done some, it provoked a lot of comment at £90. So we've tested the expensive ones, and I use the word in the loosest possible sense, because they're £150 and £220. Mm-hmm. We've then got an integrated amplifier from Avid. We last looked at an Avid product in 2015. And that was a turntable, and it will come as a bit of a surprise to people. This is not a turntable, because most people assume that that's just what Avid does. It's not just what Avid does, and you'll want to read this one, because it's quite a thing. We've got the bigger brother to last year's product of the year. So the Neat Petite Classic. We've now got the Neat Elite Classic. You'll have to see if that turns lightning strikes twice with that. And I shamefully can't remember the other things that I've done. Which is a damning indictment of my memory at the moment. But there are other reviews in the tank waiting for people to put them up. And I go, oh, yeah, I wrote that. If you've got questions, you can ask me in the comments. And, that's what's going. And then we've got, in terms of things now starting to go through for this month, there's the Boas that we've spoken about, the much-anticipated BlueOS-based streamer from Cyrus Audio. We've got an integrated amplifier from a manufacturer. Actually, that's another product that's in the tank, is a turntable from a company called Gold Note. And they're a bit weird, because they make everything. And to prove that they make everything, we're now going to look at an integrated amplifier from Gold Note. We've got a product from a large French transducer manufacturer, which is embargoed until next podcast. So I can't tell you anything more about it than that. There's just loads of stuff. Finally, things are hurtling through. So, yeah, it's all quite busy. I'm just going to finish off now with the traditional album, vinyl, and playlist thing. And the reason I was just going to have a bit of a moan. I'll be a quick moan, but I'd need to point this out. The album of this podcast is the new Chemical Brothers album, For That Beautiful Feeling. It's a very good album. I mean, it's 10 Chemical Brothers albums now, and they're still doing interesting things. And it's not a perfect album. They haven't done a perfect album since Dig Your Own Hole. But nevertheless, considering that they're not young, they're still doing interesting things. They're still breaking new ground. They're still doing things that I think are worth listening to. These are all available on major streaming services. I've now been joined by the cat. That's all lovely. And I, you know, you can listen to them on any streaming service that you care to mention. The reason this is not the vinyl release of the month is that essentially in anywhere that you choose to purchase it, it's over £40 for a double vinyl. And I think that's unconscionable. I accept that prices of everything have gone up, but they haven't, to all intents and purposes, nearly doubled. Record labels seem absolutely intent on taking something which could be grown further, developed further, and has plenty of scope for further sales if they accepted a less than intergalactic margin, and they're ignoring it. There is no way on earth that you can sustain these costs and have lots and lots of people buying it. that's not a discretionary purchase. It's a massive purchase. I'm not going to be purchasing that album at over £40. It is as simple as that. And if I lose out and for whatever reason it actually goes stratospheric afterwards, so be it. I will take my chances and let the chips fall where they may. The hardware side of this, we've kept our side of the bargain. You can buy seriously good turntables with upgradability and decent longevity for £300. The idea that that would cover off, you know, roughly 10 modern album purchases is utterly insane. And they need to do something about this. Otherwise, they're going to kill something beautiful. So I'm a little bit annoyed about that, as you can work out. I think it's tremendously short-sighted, and you know, they're just hastening their own destruction, which is the only thing I take any satisfaction in. This does mean the vinyl release is a new one from a very favourite band of mine, Public Service Broadcasting. They have done a live recording with Jules Buckley, another human being I like very, very much. It's called This New Noise. It is about the founding of the BBC, so it's all very right on. But it's a lovely, lovely thing. If you are looking at the video for this, you'll notice that the vinyl is sold out on the PSB website. I'm not a sadist. It's not sold out everywhere. You are still perfectly able to buy this from a variety of retailers. I'm not going to pretend that this is much cheaper than the Chemical Brothers one, but it is crucially a bit cheaper. And I would also say that Public Service Broadcasting has a formidable record in releasing, no pun intended, in releasing decent vinyl pressings of their albums. So this is why this one gets the nod for the vinyl release of the month. So again, it's on all the major streaming services. And this is an exciting one for you gentlemen. If you are a Qobuz subscriber, it's on Qobuz in 24-bit 5.1. And no, I don't have the faintest idea how you get that signal to your AV receiver. So someone else will probably have to work that out in the comments. But if you want to listen to it in surround and you are a Qobuz subscriber, crack on. Maybe you need an Apple TV. That would be my likely candidate for most easy way of doing this. But yes, it should be available to listen in multi-channel. And when was the last time a decent new piece of multi-channel music broke cover? So that's all very exciting as well. Playlist is much more mundane. It's not been a good month for playlists. But a random user on Spotify churned out one which they've been updating and tweaking, called Autumn Fall Indie. And I was enjoying that this morning. And I thought, it is now cooler than it was at the weekend. We are heading towards autumn. It's time to start thinking about music that you listen to whilst the leaves turn orange. So those are the recommendations. I'm sure that Andy, being the diligent soul that he is, can pop them into the podcast comments if he gets a moment. So that's where we are in terms of hi-fi and hi-fi. Yeah, I don't do AV.
Either. Okay. Well, thanks for that, Ed. I did have a quick listen to that Spotify playlist. I'll have a decent listen tomorrow, but what I heard was very good.
It's pleasing. It sort of happens pleasantly in the background, doesn't it?
So. Yeah, well, I had some writing to do this morning, and that was playing in the background after I checked what you put in the running order. So yeah, I enjoyed that. But anyway, thanks very much for the hi-fi section. And I'm just checking, we don't have any new questions on the live chat. If you do have questions, if you want to ask us anything, or if you've got any comments about what we've discussed tonight, what are your thoughts on the state of hi-fi or AV or TV? What do you think are the things that you're looking forward to and so on? Then, of course, get your questions in. The easiest way to do that is to go to AV Forums, head down to the bottom of the forum list, and you can find this podcast in there and put your question in there. I just noticed that Silverback did ask a question. Sony K95, I'm assuming it's still the TV to beat. I'm assuming you mean the A95K, which is how it's known in the UK and the US, I believe. Yes, it was a very good TV. Is it still the one to beat?
G3 now, surely. Well,
I think the G3 is definitely pushing that one. We are waiting on the A95L, which is this year's version of that TV. That's the one that we've all been waiting on. That should be arriving probably end of this month, just for me coming back from holiday. And maybe I've timed it just right, but you can keep your eyes peeled for that review. Will it be the TV to beat? I don't know. It's a lot tougher this year. But that wraps everything up. The next AV Forums podcast is the movies edition. That is along next Monday. That's the 18th of September. And they start at 8:30 in the evening. if you want to watch live. And of course, you can catch that podcast at any point after the live broadcast. And then we'll be back with the main AV Forums podcast in 2 weeks' time. That's on the 25th, Monday, the 25th of September. We start at 7 p.m. if you want to watch us live. And of course, those podcasts are available as soon as they have live streamed and finished for you to listen to at any other point. We're also available audio only on Spotify and other services. So go search us out on those if you want the audio only, so you can listen to us while you're out walking the dog early in the morning or late at night, or even commuting to work if you still do that kind of thing. But that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Jules, who had to leave us a little bit earlier. We also had Ian, Ed and Martin. Thank you very much, guys, for your time.
Thank you, sir. Always a pleasure.
And of course, if you have enjoyed the podcast, then of course, do all the cliched social media things by liking, subscribing and all the rest of it. You know the score nowadays. Everybody says it. I'm not going to repeat it, but yeah. And the only other thing I would ask is if they allow you to do 5 or 10 star reviews on the service that you listen to us on, then leave us a review if you wouldn't mind. I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for watching and listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Good night.